I'd like to start by addressing some of the things in the survey. Thank you again for doing it and for giving me some nice suggestions. So there were a few questions asking for more details about the channels, the quantum channels. So I actually put a bonus question onto this afternoon's tutorial that will hopefully help you explore some of those concepts. So I won't address them directly. There was a question about the state update rule. So I will talk a lot more in a lot more detail about that in tomorrow's lecture when we look at a different way of motivating the three postulates. So I won't say anything about that now either. There were a few questions about the differences between unital and non-unital and unitary maps. So I will say a few things about that. Also, the thing that may have added to confusion was that the feedback in the first quiz had a typo, so it may have given you the wrong impression. But if you received that feedback on the quiz, then I already emailed you to clarify that. So hopefully that wasn't too confusing. But okay, so I kind of drew this, well, I don't know if it's a Venn diagram, but this diagram to try and clarify the difference between all of the different maps. So the most general kind of map, which is the physical map given by this curly E, it just has to satisfy this condition that sum over A dagger A is equal to the identity. And so we haven't seen these maps yet. We will see them tomorrow. But these are the non-unital maps, and they can do things like increase the purity, keep the purity the same, or decrease the purity. So they can do any of those things. Then there is a subset of these maps, which are called unital, and they satisfy this extra condition where sum over A dagger equals the identity. And so these are maps that cannot increase the purity. They can keep it the same and decrease it, but they cannot increase it. And so the reason this distinction exists is that these are the kinds of maps that we can construct as probabilistic mixtures of unitary operations. Okay, and then there's an even smaller subset of maps, which are unitary maps. And these are the ones where we only have one term in the sum, and that term is equal to a unitary operator. And then these maps, they don't change the purity. All they do is, if you're in a two-dimensional system, they just rotate you on the block sphere. But more generally, in higher dimensions, they just don't change the purity. So hopefully that gives you a little bit of a clearer picture. And then tomorrow we will look at an example of this non-unital map. Okay, and then there was a question about POVMs, whether they can always be decomposed into measurement operators. And the answer is yes, they can always be decomposed into measurement operators, and we will see how to do that tomorrow, again, when we look at this other way of looking at the postulates. Okay, so before I start, are there any questions about those things? Okay, so today's lecture is the long-awaited lecture on entanglement. And we will first start with a discussion of composite systems, because in order to have entanglement, we need to have two different systems or two different two different degrees of freedom that should share that entanglement. So imagine that I have two different systems with two different Hilbert spaces, Hilbert space A and Hilbert space B. What we would like to know is what's the right mathematical structure to combine those two Hilbert spaces together. So for example, if I have Hilbert space A, well, both of them, system A and system B, and they're prepared independently, we need this Hilbert space to accommodate all possible combinations of the basis states for each Hilbert space. So if Hilbert space A has a basis A sub K, and Hilbert space B has a basis BL, then the combined Hilbert space needs to have the composite Hilbert space needs to have all combinations of these things. And so the right structure that does this is called the tensor product. Okay, so I want all possible combinations. Of the basis states. And the right structure is the tensor product. So the way I would write this is to say that the Hilbert space for the composite system is the tensor product of the Hilbert space for A and B. And the dimensionality of the Hilbert space is the product. So dimension of Hilbert space AB is going to be given by dimension of Hilbert space A times the dimension of Hilbert space B. So for example, if one Hilbert space was a two-dimensional Hilbert space with these two basis states, and the other one was a Hilbert space with these, so a three-dimensional Hilbert space with these basis states. Then the Hilbert space for the entire system is going to have all combinations. I won't write them out, but there's six of them. Okay, so does it have to be the case that it's like this? Do the state spaces for classical systems combine like this? So if we consider, let's say, a classical description, and we can parametrize the properties or the state of the classical system by a vector. So maybe we can list the properties that system A is parametrized by properties A1 and A2. And system B is parametrized by some properties, maybe B1, B2, B3. Then what kind of vector would describe the composite system of these two classical states?
Similar to that.
Pardon me?
Similar to that.
Similar? So let's try and think of an example. So I have an apple, and that apple is red and small. And I have a banana, and that banana is yellow, long, and heavy or something. then these are like 5 properties. And now I want to combine like this entire apple banana system. I just need to say that it's, well, red and small, and I forgot what the other things were. Yeah, maybe this is not clarifying it. But so you don't need to actually consider all combinations of these things classically. Like, it turns out that the vector that captures all of the classical properties is just going to be the direct sum of these two things, because they're kind of individual properties that you're assigning to things.
I thought in terms of like if they were dynamical quantities, that they would change independently of each other.
Yeah, they do.
So then like you'd want to have some permutations of all of them, I guess.
I mean, the picture, if you look, it does look very much like that, like the quantum one. And for example, if you consider not that example, but if you consider, so you have a system, you have a system of 2 particles, which don't have a spin or anything, right? Then their space of states, classically, is the phase space, right? So it's 2n, right? So it's, if it's in one dimension, the phase space of each particle is R2.
Mm-hmm.
The total phase space is a direct product of R2 with R2, which in vector, if we only care about the vector space structures, they are a sum, right? But vectors do have like position momentum of one particle and position momentum of the other, right?
Yeah, so I think what you're getting at is kind of what I was about to get to. So I think the phase space, well, maybe we can try and clarify it. So here what I'm talking about is just lists of properties that classical systems have. And so these ones, the way that they would combine is that you just, you know, you would combine this list. You can tell me if like what I'm going to say in a minute was what you were referring to. So here I would just like list all of these properties. But if I wanted to talk about probability distributions over classical parameters, then they would combine in the tensor product structure. So is that kind of where you were going, or?
Yeah, like I'm saying that it's a little bit confusing to compare two things like that, because A1, the ket A1, is the state of the system, very much in the sense that for a particle, the state of it is its position and its momentum, is the whole 2 numbers, right? So it doesn't make sense to compare the A1 on the left with the A1 on the right, because the A1 on the left is the whole information of the system. Well, of system A, why the A1 of the left is only the position. I need to open both the position, A1 and A2.
No, I think you're right. And I think you're kind of making the point that I was trying to make. So so let's just kind of leave behind this discussion of a classical system and consider, rather than describing the definite properties of the classical system, we can describe our knowledge of the classical system. So we could, rather than writing down those things, so saying that it's blue and whatever, we can write down a probability vector. So let's say, how do I want to write this? Okay, so I could, for example, parametrize my classical state in terms of probabilities over certain parameters. So I could say my system A is parametrized by this probability vector. And then my system B is parametrized by another probability vector. And then if you wanted to describe the composite system of your knowledge about the particular classical states, then the way that you would combine them is through the same tensor product structure as you do with classical mechanics. Okay, So this is what I'm going to say now, like for the next couple of minutes, is beyond the scope of this course. But I'm going to say it because you might want to ask Rob Speckens about it this afternoon in his talk. But the thing that you said was that, you know, it doesn't make sense to compare these two pictures. It makes more sense to compare these two pictures. And so this is one reason why people prefer this picture, where they talk about where they frame quantum mechanics in terms of preparations, which are more statements about our kind of knowledge of the quantum state rather than the quantum state itself. So people think about quantum theory as being a generalization of classical probability theory, or a generalization of our description of our knowledge about a particular system, rather than a generalization of the physical state of a system. So this doesn't really naturally generalize to that sort of picture, while this description of our knowledge does naturally generalize to the quantum theory picture. So that hopefully kind of now in hindsight motivates why we would rather formulate quantum theory in terms of these preparations rather than associating quantum states with the physical system of the particle between this, the preparation and the transformation. And kind of another comment that's outside of the scope of this course is another reason why people kind of try and formulate or think about quantum theory as being similar to this probabilistic description comes from the fact that it's kind of weird that in quantum theory we kind of have these two different dynamical laws. We have this one dynamical law. We have this one dynamical law that describes our transformations that apply like all the time, except in a very particular case where we actually interact with the system and make a measurement. And then we have a completely different dynamical law that's non-unitary and it's kind of weird. It's instantaneous. It like, you know, the quantum state just collapses instantaneously. While here it's a continuous, in the ideal case, unitary transformation. And it's kind of weird, you know, how would the system know that it should behave one way or the other way based on whether we're interacting with it or not? So this sometimes goes by the name the measurement problem. And it seems to be kind of a weird problem if you think about the quantum state as describing the state of the system. But it's not a problem at all if you think about the quantum state as just being a state of our knowledge, because you can think about classical probability distributions. The way they evolve in phase space is unitarily, according to maybe like the Liouville equation. And so that dynamics is just unitary and it's fine. But then as soon as you make a measurement of a system, you update your state of knowledge, you update your probability distribution in a very discontinuous way. And you know, you just like change what you know about the system because you've interacted with it. And that doesn't seem very strange at all when you think about classical probability distributions. But people kind of think of it as being really weird when you're thinking about quantum states. And the reason they think it's weird is because they associate quantum states as being the physical system rather than the state of knowledge of the system. So that's just something to think about. But as I said, it's outside of the scope of this course, but I just wanted to bring it up because it seemed relevant to this discussion. Okay. So back to the actual course. All right, so what did we see? We saw that the composite systems have a Hilbert space that consists of all products of the basis states for system A and system B. And maybe I'll just say a note on notation. We use a lot of different notations to mean the same thing. So often, if people write A, B, that's the same thing as AB, which is the same thing as A tensor B. And sometimes people put labels on things to specify which Hilbert space it is. Sometimes they don't, because there's usually a convention for the way you order Hilbert, the way you order the vectors in the tensor product. So you'll see lots of different types of notations used throughout this course and also in research. And just remember that all of these things are the same thing. Okay, so given that that description of the Hilbert space, we can now write down a general quantum state in this composite Hilbert space. So we can always write down an arbitrary state as a linear combination of the basis states in the Hilbert space. So I can say my state in Hilbert space A and B will be a sum over some coefficients. And the basis states where this coefficient C is given by the inner product of the basis states. And the initial state. And so you'll notice here I've kept the same convention that even though I've taken the conjugate transpose, the convention is to keep the states for system A on the left and the states for system B on the right. Okay, so we have this decomposition, so that's great. But it's useful to introduce another decomposition, which we'll see later on in the course becomes useful when we're talking about entanglement. And this is known as a Schmidt decomposition. Okay, so anytime you have a state that's decomposed like this, you can always find a decomposition in this form. Okay, so a decomposition in this form where lambda I are non-negative numbers, where the squares of those numbers add to one, and the phi and other phi are orthonormal in the sense that phi I phi j is equal to delta ij and the other phi, the other phi j, is also equal to dij. So this decomposition looks kind of similar to that one, but it's a little bit different. Can you see how it's different? Yeah?
There's only one summation index.
Yeah, exactly. So there's only one summation index. To the larger to the dimension of the larger Hilbert space.
Okay, and when you go over the dimension of the smaller one, like, where are those?
What do you mean?
Just like, say K is less than L, then the phi's, only K of them would be like orthogonal to each other.
No, so, I mean, there's just as many of these guys as there is of those guys. So one way to think about it is the way in practice that you would compute the Schmidt decomposition is by doing a singular value decomposition. And so I think when you have a matrix where the dimension along here is different, well, the number of rows is different to the columns. I'm gonna see how this goes. I think you have a diagonal matrix. Yeah, I'm not gonna be able to do this one. There's totally a question on the tutorial where you guys go through and like figure out like exactly like how these things work. But now off the top of my head, I can't remember how the structure of the singular value decomposition goes. But the number of elements here in this matrix is going to correspond to the number of elements in this sum. And then so the number of basis states is going to correspond to that. But then the thing that changes amongst these guys is how many terms there. So each one of these is going to be written as a sum over those AKs, and each one of these is going to be some sum over those BKs. So the number of terms in the sum that defines this state is going to be different for these two Hilbert spaces. But maybe that'll become more clear in the tutorial. But you can always find this decomposition just by doing a singular value decomposition. Yep.
Is there any infinite dimensional analog of the Schmidt decomposition?
Is there an infinite dimensional
analog of this decomposition?
Yes. Yeah, in practice, I like always just discretize things and do the singular value decomposition, but you can do it in a continuous system. Was the question about continuous or infinite? Because, I mean, you can have a discrete system where this ranges from one to infinity. But I guess then, yeah, it doesn't need to be continuous. Yeah, in practice, people do deal with those systems. I've never dealt with the continuous ones though. Yep. Okay. Okay, so one thing to notice about this decomposition is that if there is more than one term in this decomposition, then you cannot, okay, so if more than one term in the decomposition, then you cannot write the state psi AB as some tensor product, let's call it. Okay, so if there's more than one term, you can't write that. And that's actually what we use to define whether a system is entangled or not. Yeah, so coming back to the continuous question, I'm like now just trying to remember. So yeah, you can have situations where the Hilbert space is continuous. So it could be some sort of state described over, like maybe it's a particle over real space. And so it can have a wave function that's kind of some sort of continuous wave function. And then you can do the Schmidt decomposition, and then the number of terms is finite. So for example, if this guy corresponded to a Gaussian wave packet and that guy corresponded to a Gaussian wave packet, you would have a term, you would have only one term in the Schmidt decomposition. But then you can have, you know, this thing is a sum of a product of Gaussian wave packets plus a product of other wave packets that like maybe are some other Hermite polynomial that's orthogonal to that. And so it's continuous. But the number of terms is going to be finite in the Schmidt decomposition. So situations like that can exist, and they can be used to quantify whether the state is entangled or not. Okay, so as I said, if you have more than one term, you can't decompose it as a tensor product of states like this, and that's what we use to define entanglement. So with that, let me move on to entanglement and just give you the definition in terms of this for pure states, and then I'll also give you a definition for mixed states. Okay, so a pure state psi AB of a composite system AB. So AB labels the composite system that can be expressed as psi AB equals phi A phi B is called a separable state. Otherwise, it is called entangled. We can also write down a definition for mixed states. And it is a mixed state rho AB of a composite system AB that can be expressed as rho AB is the sum over some probability PI and the tensor product of rho A and rho B is called separable. Otherwise, it is called entangled. So the definition for mixed states is a little bit different to the definition for for pure states, because here you just need to be able to write it as a tensor product to be separable, while here there's a more general way of writing a separable state. So even though it doesn't seem separable in the sense that you know, I have a term of different products, so it seems like I can't factorize it, but in this definition, it's still, if it can be written like that, it's called separable, otherwise it's entangled. So let's look at a couple of examples. So is that state entangled? Yes. And the reason it's entangled is because it cannot be written as a product of a pure state on Hilbert space A and a pure state on Hilbert space B. Okay, so what are the implications of this? Well, the one thing that people always always point out for entangled states like this is that you could have some scenario where, let's say, you have two parties, Alice and Bob, and let's say you prepare this entangled state and give the particle for system A to Alice and the particle for system B to Bob. And then Bob goes to the moon and Alice stays on Earth. And then Alice makes a measurement on her system in, let's say, the 0-1 basis, and then she gets outcome 0. So in that case, well, we can use the state update rule to find out what the state of the system is after measurement. So we start off with this state, we apply the state update rule, which if you go through it, find, if she gets outcome 0, it picks out this term. And so then you can say, well, instantaneously, Bob's particle collapsed into the state 0. And so then people are like, whoa, that's like really impressive. Entanglement lets you, you know, do these, I guess, well, it doesn't let you communicate anything, but it lets you instantaneously affect another system that's like on the other side of the universe or on the other side of the solar system or whatever, or just on the moon. So you, I mean, you might be impressed by this, and in popular science, like, people often give this this motivation for why entanglement is like so amazing. But let me just contrast this with another example, which is a classical example. And I'll tell you why in a second, why it's classical. But imagine I have a state like this. Okay, so here's my other example, so example 2. Now, is this state entangled? So I'm seeing a no. Yeah, it's not entangled. And the reason it's not entangled is because, well, according to our definition of what entangled is that if I can write it like this, then it's a separable state. And here I have a decomposition with two terms, the density matrix, tensor product, density matrix plus, density matrix, tensor product, density matrix. So this state is not entangled, but I can go through that same scenario as I just described. You know, I prepare some type of state like this. So maybe what I do is I have some preparation procedure that with probability 1/2, I prepare two red balls and put a red ball into Alice's box and a red ball into Bob's box, but they can't see what it is. And with probability half, I prepare a blue ball, two blue balls, put one in the Alice's box and one in Bob's box, and then they go off. Bob goes to the moon, Alice stays on Earth, and then Alice opens up her box and says, oh, it's a red ball. So instantaneously, I've collapsed Bob's box, the ball in Bob's box, into a red ball. So, like, that's exactly the same scenario as I had with this entangled state here. And, like, it doesn't seem very magical or anything. So what, in fact, is it that makes the entangled state special compared to this not entangled state, when they both seem to have this property that everybody claims is special about entanglement? I'll let you guys think about that for a minute. You already know the answer. Yeah.
No, it's just, it seems not so magic if they have to meet somewhere and say, okay, we have, we know that one ball is red.
Mm-hmm.
They have this information in addition, and then they go, and then they have immediate information on the other state because they have to meet somewhere.
Well, they don't have to. Bob could be on the moon, and I could just make this preparation and then put the box on a rocket and send it to Bob. The same way that I could prepare an entangled state here and just put one of those particles on the rocket and send it to Bob. So they don't necessarily have to be physically there when the preparation of either this state or that state is made.
But example two is still, it makes the state so that you can, you still cannot make sure that you're the zero state or the one state, because it's mixed. And being mixed means that you don't know what will you pick out.
No, but here as well, if I measure in the 0-1 basis, I don't know if I'm going to get outcome 0 or outcome 1.
It's pure state, you know. For sure, if the state you picked is 0 and for Bob is still 0 and...
But you don't get the choice to pick 0. When you make a measurement, you say, I'm measuring in the 0-1 basis, and outcome 0 or 1 is not in your control. That just happens randomly.
You mean the...
Like, I mean, so maybe it's not so clear to see, but we could compute the Born rule here. We could just take this state and apply, so we can have a projector for Alice. Let's say Alice's projector, outcome 0, identity for Bob. So that's one projector, because I'm measuring Alice's state, not Bob's. And then I have another projector for Alice for outcome 1, identity for Bob. So I make a projective measurement on Alice's particle, or on the entire state for in this basis, and then I can compute the probability of getting outcome 0 is going to be a half, probability of getting outcome 1 is going to be a half. I can't control what the Alice can't control what the outcome will be. It'll just happen. And it's exactly the same thing here. You can compute the probability of getting outcome 0 and the probability of getting outcome 1. And they will again be a half and a half.
But I think we can compute the conditional probability.
Conditional property?
Yeah,
probability?
After you already know that you get P0,
mm-hmm.
and then compute the conditional probability of example 1, and then you will find that for Bob, the P0 is 1.
Yeah.
And if we continue to compute the example 2, we will find that the probability for Bob is still 1 over half.
No. If you do the state update rule for this state and give an outcome 0, you compute the state update rule, you'll get that. So given outcome 0, the state update rule will tell you that now the joint state of Alice's and Bob's system will be like this. So now the probability of Bob's state being 0 is going to be 1. The conditional probability will be 1 as well.
What if you measure the different bases?
Bingo, exactly. That's the point. So the whole discussion we've been having here is in the 0-1 basis. And so both of these states are equally correlated in the 0-1 basis. But if we measure in a different basis, we'll find that whatever basis we measure in for this state, it's going to be correlated. So I can make a measurement in the plus one by plus minus basis. And then if Alice gets the outcome plus, it's going to project Bob's state into the state plus. If she measures in the plus I minus I basis, I think it's anti-correlated, but it's still like the correlations are just as strong. While in this basis, it's only correlated perfectly in the 0-1 basis. But if we try to make a measurement in an orthogonal basis, we find that intuitively what we find, what will happen is the thing you're trying to describe here. So it's kind of hard to do the whole calculation, but maybe let's see if we can get some intuition for this. So I think this state, I can just rewrite it. If you just go through the math, like plug in the definitions for 0 and 1 in terms of the plus minus basis, you will find that you can write this like that. Where the plus minus are just the usual definitions we've been using in the course. Now, I don't want to go through and rewrite this in the plus minus basis because it's a mess, but
you can kind of like restrict the space by first making a measurement in the 0.
Exactly. Basis. Yeah. No, that's exactly the right thing to do. So rather than rewriting it, what we're going to do is now measure this. Let's say Alice measures in the plus minus basis and gets outcome plus. Then you will get that the state update rule projects Alice's state into the state plus, and then Bob's state into a state like that. So now, given our outcome plus, if you then were to make a measurement in Bob's state in the plus minus basis, it's still going to be random. You don't know which one you'll get. So then the what you were saying, the conditional probabilities are going to be different between these two things in the other basis. So that's the strength of entanglement, is that it's a correlation that's much stronger than a classical correlation. Because what we were describing here was really this classical preparation procedure. I was saying with probability something I do this, with probability something I do that. While here, this is a quantum correlation, which we call entanglement, which tells us that we have correlations in all of the different bases, not just the basis in which we were preparing things. So yeah, next time you see in like the newspaper them talking about like that entanglement is special because it lets you do that scenario that I just described, you'll know that that's not true because you can do that with classical probabilities as well. Okay, so let's move on. Okay, so now imagine that you have a friend that's preparing an entangled state. So they're preparing a state of two systems. And you know, you could, if you wanted to, prepare many copies of that state and characterize the entire composite system and get the density matrix for that. But let's say if rather than your friend giving you both systems or both particles, they decide to keep one of them and only give you the other one. So let's say they prepare some system consisting of two particles A and B, and they just give you A. how would you determine what the proper description of just particle A is? And I don't mean mathematically, I just mean like if somebody gives you that particle, what would you do? What do you know, I mean, for any, like anytime somebody gives you a quantum state and you want to know what it is, what would you do?
Tomography.
Sorry?
Tomography.
Yeah, yeah. So given if you had multiple preparations, you could do tomography. So let's assume that your friend can prepare multiple copies of the same entangled state, and they're always going to give you particle A. And if you want to know what the density matrix is for just that state, you would do quantum state tomography. So if you want to know the state of system A, you can do quantum state tomography. Okay, great. So what would you get if you did quantum state tomography? Well, you would get some kind of density matrix or density operator. So even though we have this description of the state in the composite system, there exists some description that just gives you information about particle A. And so it means there should be, well, hopefully, you know, if I can go through this physical procedure where, you know, if somebody keeps giving me half of an entangled state and I can characterize it and write down the density matrix just for that state, hopefully there's some mathematical way that I can get from this description of the composite system to this description of just one of the subsystems. And the mathematical procedure for doing that is to compute something called the partial trace. So how to get rho A from psi AB? Well, you do something called the partial trace. So let's actually make this more general and assume I have some mixed state. On the composite system. So the partial trace is usually denoted by the trace, which you would be familiar with, and then a little subscript that tells you the Hilbert space over which you're tracing out. And then inside, you just put the density operator for the composite system. And so we can define this as being a sum over I actually, let me just write this out. Okay, so the way that you would compute it is you would start with your density operator and then you apply kind of a trace on Hilbert space B. So what we're doing is we're summing over all of the basis states, the diagonal. If you think of it as a matrix, you're summing over all the diagonals in this basis. But we're doing nothing to system A, so we've got this identity here. And because it's kind of a mess to write this every time, usually people just write things like this, where there's an implicit identity here acting on system A. But you can see that If this thing can be decomposed in a basis corresponding to A and B, and then we have all of these inner products between the B bases here and here, then the Hilbert space for system B is just going to disappear away, and you'll just be left with a description on system A. Okay, so let's do an example, and it's going to be a little bit tedious, but I want to do the tedious version so then I can motivate why you should be using a useful trick to simplify the calculations. Okay, so example. So imagine I have row AB, which is just a pure state, where I'm going to write this pure state in terms of its Schmidt decomposition. Like that. So then to compute the reduced density matrix, we're going to write, so row A will be a sum over the basis states in system B. Okay, so here I've just written out the state psi and then the bra corresponding to that, and then I've sandwiched everything inside the basis states for system B. And now I can use the fact that these things are orthonormal to get rid of some of these sums. Well, actually, I haven't gotten rid of the sums yet, but I have some delta functions. Like that. And then I can use the delta functions to collapse the sums. And the thing that I'm left with now is a description of the reduced density operator for system A, given this entangled system AB. Okay, so that can get quite messy. It was simplified because we had things in terms of the Schmidt decomposition. Things can get even more messy when you don't have that. But there is a trick that you can do that saves you going through all of this. So the trick is that whenever you have some density operator like this written out in the basis, you can just make this replacement. So for each term, replace guess it doesn't matter. So every time you see something like, so if you're trying to trace out system B, every time you see that, just swap these guys around and then take the inner product. And then you don't have to mess around with explicitly writing down the trace in terms of the sum over basis states. It's, and trust me, it'll simplify your calculations a lot if you just do that every time you want to trace something out. And you'll get some experience with doing these calculations in the tutorials. Okay, so that's what you would have gotten for system A if you did the calculation for system B. And so you trace out system A. You would get a sum over the same coefficients, but now the basis will be different. And it'll be for system B. Okay, so at this point, can we make any statements that relate some properties of the reduced state to whether the initial state was entangled or not? So do we have any? Where's the entangled state? Okay. So there's the description of the definition of an entangled state. So we can see that, well, for both of these reduced density matrices, if we have more than one term in the Schmidt decomposition, then this state is going to be a mixed state. You won't be able to write it as just the outer product of a Brauer and a Kett. While if the composite state has only one term in the Schmidt decomposition, it's a pure state, but it's also unentangled, then the reduced density operator is going to be pure. So there's this relationship between whether the bipartite system is entangled and whether the reduced density operator is mixed. And that's actually one thing that we can use to quantify the amount of entanglement in a pure composite system by looking at the reduced density matrix and computing how pure it is. So I now want to talk a little bit about characterizing entanglement using that notion. Okay, so let's see. The purity of the reduced state is the one that we have after we trace out the other system, is related to the entropy of the system. So the more pure it is, the less entropy it's going to have. And we can use this to characterize the entanglement as follows. So we can say the entropy for system A is given by minus trace of rho A log rho A which has a really nice form in terms of the Schmidt decomposition, or in terms of the Schmidt coefficients from the Schmidt decomposition. And since it only depends on the Schmidt coefficients, you can see that there's going to be the symmetry between the entropy for system A and also for system B. So that will also be minus trace of rho B log rho B, which will be defined as the entropy for system B. So if E is equal to 0 for either subsystem, then the composite system is separable. And then the higher E, the more entangled the composite system is. Okay, but there's a caveat to all of this, and that's only true if, well, it necessarily has to be because I'm writing it like that. But if, well, let's say if composite system is pure, Okay, and that's important because you can imagine a situation where you have a state, a mixed state that's not entangled, like this one. And if you compute the reduced density matrix, you would get something that's completely mixed, but it doesn't tell you anything about the amount of entanglement. So while if you know that the system is pure, then if you compute the reduced density matrix and you get a maximally mixed state, then we define that as being the thing that we define that to mean that the composite system was maximally entangled. You have a question?
Yeah. Are the lambda k's the same or different for the rho A and rho B?
Well, they will be the same because the Schmidt decomposition only has. So that lambda is like the same lambda, yeah. Okay, so let's make a definition. A maximally entangled state, maximally AB is one for which the reduced state is maximally mixed. Just so it's clear, these things are the Schmidt coefficients. Okay, so probably, yeah?
So are those partial traces?
That trace is just a, well, we're only dealing, at this point, we're only dealing with the reduced density matrix already. So there's just one system. So it's a trace over that system. So we've already traced out the other guy. And similarly here, we're dealing with the other system and traced out system A. Yeah?
In this equation, you already assumed that the row is pure, right?
Yes.
So
well, okay, no. Well, no. No. So here, I could just imagine that row A is not even the reduced density matrix for a Hilbert space. It could just be some density operator.
With the next equality, you use the Schmidt coefficients for the...
Yeah. So, okay, yeah. So at this point, yeah, at this point, I'm assuming that the that this density operator is the reduced density operator for some pure state on A.
The first equality defines entropy in general. And
yep.
The second one, you assume that the state is pure so that you can use the Schmidt.
Yep. Yeah, and you could compute the reduced density matrix of a system that's of a composite system that's not pure, but then it doesn't tell you anything about the amount of entanglement. Yeah. Okay, so well, yeah, probably the last thing that we have time for today is to talk about how we would characterize entanglement for a mixed state, a mixed composite state. So that's actually a really tricky problem, and it's a huge area of research that people haven't, I mean, nobody has found a great way of doing this for arbitrary systems, but there are some things that we do know for very special cases. And so I will talk about one of those today. Yes?
Can you go over this definition again? Because I didn't quite follow that was supposed to be, you can only do that once rho is pure. So how does this discussion about being
naturally mixed up? No. Rho is not necessarily pure.
Okay.
But if rho is, this is always gets confusing. What I'm assuming is that the composite system for AB is pure, but then the reduced density operator for one of the systems is not necessarily pure. So yeah, there's a few things. So this thing is just the definition of entropy. And so I can, for any density operator I have, whether it comes from an entangled state or I just prepare it on my own, I can compute something called the entropy. But now if I say that if rho A is the reduced density matrix of some system, of some composite system AB, then I can do this, write it like this, where lambda, k are the Schmidt coefficients of the Schmidt decomposition of that state. Yeah.
I mean, and I just wanted to add that you can always use that equation in the middle as well. It's just that.
Oh, yeah. If you can just.
Lambda to be the.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So in the particular case, that rho sub A comes from a pure state in the combined system, then the eigenvalues of rho sub A will be the Schmidt coefficients.
Okay.
But in general, that formula is always valid if one
understands
the lambda k as the eigenvalues of rho.
So let's just, poor Josh is going to have to take another screenshot. But OK, let's say lambda k are the eigenvalues of rho A, but if rho A equals that, then lambda k are also Schmidt coefficients. Is that okay?
The eigenvalues are actually lambda k squared.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, no, but this is great because this gets really confusing, and so it's good to get it all clear. Okay. So now let's look at characterizing mixed entangled states. Okay, so this is a good place to recall that definition from the other day about a completely positive map. So the definition is that row AB at some given time, well, let me write it down and then I'll say it. This always gets so confusing. Okay, so I'm just going to talk about this for a little while. So one of the questions on the quiz was, what does this mean? So I think, yeah, what I need to clarify is that this whole thing here is a map on system A and system B, which maybe I should write it as, let's call it FAB acting on row AB. Like this. So what I'm imagining is I have, let's say, some entangled, or well, some possibly entangled state that I'm creating, row AB. And then I'm applying a map to both of them. And then I'm checking whether the state that comes out here is positive. But it's a very particular map, FAB, which is actually decomposed into this map E on row A and doing nothing to row B, which then I can just write as I'm applying E on A and doing nothing to B. So in this case, the way that I've defined F is like that. So what this means is that it's a map on system A and B, but I'm only applying this map E on system A and doing nothing to system B. And this complete map takes as an input row AB and then outputs some row AB at a later time. And so the statement is that this map here, EA, is completely positive if it takes a, oh shoot, sorry. Guys, no one's checking what I'm, okay, let me say it again. The statement is that E is completely positive if it takes a positive row AB that might be entangled and outputs a positive AB at the end. Okay. And so this is important because you can have maps that are positive, so would just take a input a single system density operator that's positive and spit out a single system density operator that's positive. But it wouldn't necessarily do that when that density operator is part of a larger entangled state. Yes?
Does this depend on the system B? Or just should it hold for every?
It should hold for every system, yeah.
Okay. So in order to be completely positive, the I can choose an arbitrary B and it should be always positive in this sense.
Well, an arbitrary row A B.
Okay, so I'm asking whether the system B is fixed. So the inlet space B.
For
all Bs.
For all B, for all Bs and all preparations within A B.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, and so the reason it's important to make that distinction is because even though a map needs to be completely positive for it to be a physical map, you can still use maps that are non-physical, just mathematical maps, as a way of characterizing whether a given density operator is entangled or not. And so this is known as the positive partial transpose criterion. So I will, okay, how do I want to say it? So all physical maps should be completely positive. Okay, and what's an example of a map? That is positive, but not completely positive. Well, this is a map called the partial transpose. So this doesn't describe a physical operation, but given some density matrix written down on paper, I can just apply the partial transpose. And when I do that, let's see how that tells me. It always gets like really subtle. Well, let me see if I can. Well, let me first define the partial transpose, and then we'll show how it can be used to characterize entanglement. So, okay, I can always write an arbitrary bipartite state as follows. Okay, so then the partial transpose with respect to system B is as follows. Okay, so ultimately what it comes down to is just switching these two coefficients in this tensor. But if you want to do it at the level of the basis states, then it's a matter of just transposing the labels of the second system B. Okay, so how do we use it to characterize entanglement? Well, if we apply partial transpose and get negative eigenvalues, then we know that rho AB was entangled. Yep.
Do you mean the identity on A?
Yeah. So how does this work? Well, if rho AB were not entangled, then applying the partial transpose on B is always going to give me a positive density matrix because the partial transpose is a positive map. So if they're not entangled, I put in rho B has positive eigenvalues, it comes out, it has positive eigenvalues. But if they're entangled, it's possible that what comes out has negative eigenvalues because the partial transpose is not a completely positive map.
Sorry, can you show that it's not a complete positive map?
Can I show it?
Yeah.
I don't know how we can. Well, we can see that it's, I mean, you can find an example where if you put in an entangled state and get negative eigenvalues, that means that it's not completely positive, given the definition of completely positive. I don't know how you would prove that it's not a, apart from like by example. I mean, but I think that's sufficient to show if that's the if the definition of a completely positive map is one that always gives you a positive density operator, and now you have a map that doesn't give you a positive density operator, then it's not completely positive. Yeah. So because it's positive, and then it'll always give me positive eigenvalues if I put in unentangled states. But if I put in an entangled state, then it might give me negative eigenvalues. So when it does give me negative eigenvalues, I can say that the system was entangled. But if it gives me positive eigenvalues, I can't say anything for sure, except in very special cases where I have a 2x2 dimensional system or a 2x3 dimensional system. So meaning if system A is a 2-dimensional system and system B is a 2-dimensional system, then this is necessary and sufficient. And if system A has 2 and system B has 3 dimensions, it's necessary and sufficient. Otherwise, it's only, what's the technical word for it? It's an entanglement witness. So if it gives you negative eigenvalues, you can say for sure that it's entangled, but if it gives you positive eigenvalues, you can't say for sure, except in that case. Okay, so I have a few things I wanted to say about how to generate entanglement, but we've run out of time, so you guys can just read the notes. It's only like half a page. And I just wanted to finish with saying why entanglement is interesting. Well, it's fundamentally interesting because it's a correlation that's stronger than a classical correlation. And if you have entanglement, you can do certain things that you couldn't do otherwise. So one example is teleportation, which again, we won't get to cover in the lecture because we're running behind, but I put a bonus tutorial question on tomorrow's tutorial where you can go through the whole teleportation protocol yourself just by following the questions. So if you're interested, you can do that. There's something else called superdense coding, which allows you to send 2 bits of information by only sending 1 physical bit. So that's another example of where entanglement gives you some extra power that you wouldn't usually have. It's also related to decoherence. So when you have quantum systems and superpositions, they usually decohere by becoming entangled with an environment. And so that's just like important to understand if you're trying to build a quantum computer and protect it from, you know, from the environment, so to make sure that it like functions properly. But it's also just interesting from a conceptual perspective. Maybe it's the reason why we don't see Schrodinger cats in, you know, in real everyday life. So it's just important to understand this thing from a fundamental level. Yeah, and it's also, you've seen examples of it coming up in condensed matter, so they can use entanglement to quantify interesting phases of matter. So it seems to come up everywhere. So it's something that exists and we don't completely understand it. So it behooves us to try and understand it even more. And it seems to give us extra power that we wouldn't have, but it also seems to do negative things. So if we want to mitigate those negative things, we need to understand it more carefully. Okay, so I will finish with that. And then tomorrow, well, I'll see you guys this afternoon for the tutorial. And then tomorrow we'll use this idea of composite systems and entanglement to understand the realistic postulates in a different way.